It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley are here. We've got a big discussion about why Microsoft had so much trouble with their latest Windows update, 1809. We'll look ahead at 19H1. Paul will explain why Apple is or isn't a monopolist. I'm not sure what his position was on that one. And, of course, our picks of the week. It's all coming up next with Windows Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Windows Weekly with Paul Thurrott and Mary Jo Foley, episode 597, recorded Wednesday, November 28th, 2018. Go Deep Racer. Windows Weekly is brought to you by Slide Belts by Brig Taylor, high-quality, comfortable ratchet belts that are easy to adjust. If you want a better belt, go to slidebelts.com/twit and use the code TWIT for 20% off. And by Grammarly. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently. Go to grammarly.com/windows and get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today. It's time for Windows Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Microsoft. On the panel today, the same old people. Mary Jo Foley from Microsoft.
Making their 1,630
seconds. They're still here.
Yep, actually, they refuse to die.
With the exception of Brad
Slowly
Sams,
adding arsenic to the Christmas
nobody
present.
Nobody expects Paul and Mary Jo. Paul Thurrott is at Thurrott.com, T-H-U-R-R-O-T-T.com, and together they actually are the dynamic duo of Microsoft Reportage.
We are literally the dynamic duo.
Yes. One's Batman, one's Robin. I'll let you decide which is which. Hello.
Hello.
Did you have a propitious Thanksgiving feast?
Well, I never wanted Thanksgiving to end.
Oh, it was that good. What was it so good? What was so good?
Well, first of all, this is the one time of year that I eat carbs with abandon. So I have a lot of stuffing mostly. I don't really eat potatoes. But I think I was like poisoned by carbs over this weekend. It was wonderful.
You had no resistance. That's why.
Right. You know how like people always associate falling asleep with turkey, the tryptophan thing or whatever. I don't actually know the foods off the top of my head, but I believe if you look at what people typically eat for Thanksgiving, there's actually other foods that are higher in tryptophan than turkey, but whatever. I passed out like a sailor on shore leave, like Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday afternoon when we had leftovers. Like I was like narcoleptic. I've never seen anything like this.
I blame the gravy.
Yeah, could be.
Mm-mm-mm.
I want to do that again. Could we do Thanksgiving again this week? Doesn't Canada have a different Thanksgiving?
Yeah, in October. You missed
it. They already have it.
You got to start earlier, Paul. That's the key. Start your Thanksgiving in October. And pretty soon, Paul's going to say, I only eat carbs in months that have an R
yes,
in them.
Right.
Something like that.
It will be every other week. And then it really, honestly, let me think about this. Yeah, pretty much just the stuffing. Although, actually, on Thanksgiving Day itself, my sister had these biscuit things. You know, those little
biscuits.
They come apart in layers when you.
Oh, yeah, those are good.
My brother-in-law came around with the tray, and he kind of stuck in front of me. I'm like, yeah, I don't really eat that stuff. You know that. He goes, eat one.
You'll be glad. Oh, those are good.
So much
butter.
But how
was your Thanksgiving? Yeah, you do.
I have a lot of ham left over if you want to come on over. I made way too much stuffing, too. The cornbread stuffing.
You make cornbread stuffing.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's a little southern. Next
we
time.
We had a multicultural thing, actually. There was jacked corn was a thing. Like, there's some weird Pennsylvania Dutch stuff going on, too.
Oh, yeah. Yum. Did you have cracklins?
There was no cracklins. I don't know.
I had tofu and mushrooms, if anyone cares.
This is the problem with a vegetarian.
There's nothing more depressing than your Thanksgiving
Vegetarian
menu.
Thanksgiving is so sad.
Guys, you would have liked it. I roasted mushrooms with sriracha and maple syrup and then had roasted tofu.
My daughter is also a vegetarian, and she has her own stuffing we put aside that is probably tasteless and terrible. And, you know, her fake jerky, whatever that is, tofu something, nonsense, whatever. But I always... You guys should spend that. You and my daughter should spend Thanksgiving together. You know, I bet you guys would find a copacetic meal plan.
You know what? The best parts of Thanksgiving are the sides. All the vegetables, like squash and Brussels sprouts.
That's true of any meal, actually. The best parts are the sides. When I go to one of those fancy French multi-course dinners, it's always the meat course that's the most boring. Mm-hmm. All the stuff leading up to.
I hear you, and I love the stuffing, but seriously, when you take the turkey out, it has to sit there for about an hour.
Yeah.
And then you cut the thing up and you pull off the fatty.
Okay, that's pretty good.
My wife brines this thing for 4 days. Yeah. It's perfect. Mm. And it's like this awesome fatty skin in the underside of the bird. It's just, I'm already full before we even sit down.
Yum. Yum. Eat the skin first.
What about cranberry sauce?
That's pretty good. Look,
does it shock out of
real
a can?
We left ours in the fridge, in the can. We forgot to open it again.
No, it's real cranberry sauce.
I'm working on a theory that cranberry sauce was retribution from the Indians to the pilgrims. And it was literally designed to poison them.
I do, too. I do, too.
Come on.
I have a raw cranberry sauce. It's pretty good. Take a bag of cranberries. You throw it in a blender with some orange juice and I can't remember what else.
And 3 coconut. Pounds of sugar because it's a cranberry thing.
Oh, yeah, you have to put
thing.
Some sugar
It's very bitter.
Yeah, it's like, what do you call that? Strawberry, it's like rhubarb.
Yeah, rhubarb's a little bitter.
It's like
unless
marsh
it
rhubarb.
Strawberry. Marsh rhubarb. That's what the Indians called it. Yeah, have marsh rhubarb. Right. You love it.
Even our animals want to eat this when they're starving.
I know why you guys would rather talk about carbs. Because if you don't, it's going to be 1809 all over again.
Again.
It is
and
kind
again.
Of our version of Groundhog Day when you think about it.
Endless.
I know.
Endless. So
what happened this week in 1809?
This week in 1809. I like it. It's our new show.
So, okay, here's my question, though, which I was thinking about in the shower today because who knows why. But isn't it the case that with every Windows 10 build, they come out with it, they start rolling it out to the mainstream, and then they fix it afterwards, right? Then they start rolling out cumulative update after cumulative update to fix it.
Well,
yes.
By the way, yes. But the things that they're fixing this time were particularly dramatic.
They were.
Starting
with data loss.
Yeah. Remember, I always compare this to the anniversary update when the Kindles were blue screening PCs and whatever else happened. It's that kind of thing,
Right.
But
I was feeling was, okay, they screwed up 1809. They had to pull it. They had to re-release it. They're just trickling it out now. But it feels like every day we're finding out about yet another thing that doesn't work with it. But I feel like we're extra on edge about this and we're really watching for this time.
Of course. I mean, yes.
More
than
previous.
If you get hit by a car, you're gonna, look at both ways like 3 or 4 times the next time you cross the street. Like,
right. I feel like other times, I feel like this has happened, but we haven't been as on it like we are with this one. No,
it's no one's fault but Microsoft's. The problem is the quality was really a lot lower this time.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that these little bugs that we're seeing, and there are some, are being overplayed.
Well, most of them are. Yeah, okay. Most of them are not earth-shattering huge problems, right? I don't know if this is in the notes, but there's a bug in Windows Media Player with 1809 where the scrub bar or whatever, the seek bar, it doesn't work. It doesn't do anything. And, I carted out this ancient piece of software to see what it was like, and sure enough, it doesn't work. I probably haven't used Windows Media Player in 10 years? I don't know. Long time.
Right.
To who does this impact? I don't know. I'm sure there are some people who use it, right? There are still people
who raises an interesting
rip
question
CDs and whatever.
About Microsoft's testing, because they eliminated the testers who would have presumably dug into every nook and cranny, regardless of how often used.
Maybe.
Well, but I mean, this in theory, regardless of how often used, and might have discovered something like that. Whereas if you rely on the general populace to find bugs, if it's a little used program, maybe they won't find the bug.
Let's hash this one out for a second, because I'm curious where you both stand on this. That's the thing, right? So Satya Nadella came in and became CEO. This is the story, right? And he instituted all these changes. There was the story last week about the book he read that inspired him to make all these cultural changes at Microsoft and whatever. Okay.
That's the day you dread when the CEO comes in and said, hey, I just read a book.
I read a book.
Yeah. And you're all going to read it, too.
Uh-huh. Yes. There we go. I've sent one to each of you.
Please be one of those Contessa cooking books or something. Anyway, one of the things that happened, this is the story. You can tell me if I'm wrong. But is that, they laid off this testing organization, right? And they started the Windows Insider program as an alternative, right? And by the way, in many ways, the Windows Insider program has been very successful. Several million people actively testing every version of Windows. So this is the question I have, assuming what I just said is accurate in any way, shape, or form. Is this an acceptable?
Yeah, which is better.
Regardless of. Is it something like, should we complain that this happened? I mean, doesn't it? I guess the Windows Insider program is kind of a microcosm of the real world. It seems to me has the ability to find problems that rote testing would never find, mm-hmm. Theoretically. I think there are problems with how Microsoft triages data and all that.
Yeah. So you're missing one step in your explanation of what happened. Well, actually two. So they did lay off.
Actually 13, Paul. They laid off
many. I don't know. I don't know if it was all of the people who are like dedicated quality assurance testers in Windows, but it doesn't mean they don't test Windows Inside still. They do. I mean, they don't just say, okay, Windows Insiders, go test this. That's not like that, right? I mean, they have different rings inside the company, like the Canary ring, where they test it inside. And when they did lay off the testers, the explanation they gave was, we're going to have the people who are writing Windows start writing unit tests for Windows and test it themselves. Because in theory, who better to test the code than the people writing it? Which I don't know enough about software to know.
I completely disagree with that.
But I feel like if I apply the example of writing to it, I don't think writers should be editing their own stories, right?
We had kind of addressed this.
We did.
Cultural problem at Microsoft where what they're rewarded for is new stuff, right? That's why the biggest, the brightest and the best always move on to some new thing because that's where the rewards are. If you can get a business going inside of Microsoft, right, this is how you win. Staying back on the Windows team and writing unit tests to test software that was first written 12 years ago or something to make sure it still works with the baloney new features no one's ever going to use in the new version of Windows has got to be the most thankless task imaginable, and culturally at Microsoft, the most thankless task, literally, in the sense that they'll never be rewarded for finding anything. You're going to get crapped on if you don't find something like this Windows Media Player thing. But had you found that, you weren't going to get a basket of apples or anything. Right. Like, no one was going to ever reward you for that.
Right. No, I think the problem is not so, like, I think we got to stop saying they should rehire testers. I don't think they're going to. Like, I don't that's a thought at Microsoft. But I think, us going back to the thing we talk about a lot, which is you need a way to figure out how to pay people or incent people or reward people for doing that kind of grunt work is a valid point.
Yeah. I think this is the biggest mistake of the Satya Nadella era, with the understanding that it's not unique to him. This has always been the cultural problem at Microsoft. So they're busy kind of patting themselves on the back for all the great changes they made and hooray for accessibility and all the other stuff they're doing, which is great. This is a major issue. It's the finish the job thing I always talk about. It's always been Microsoft's Achilles heel.
Yep.
All right. And you're right.
I'm
disagreeing with it.
Yeah. I think you could also safely say that what in-house testing and testers do is very different from insiders, and they need both. And I think the proof is in the pudding, which is that some serious show-stopping bugs emerged in production code. Mm-hmm. So, but
it's
I think you're right, Paul. The really difficult thing probably for Microsoft is not launching a new feature, but testing for interactions between new features and old code.
And how complex must this be, given this enormous code base that has existed for decades in some cases?
And that, I think, has to be done in-house. I don't think you can count on insiders to find those problems.
I think if Microsoft had not changed the way they develop Windows, this might have worked. But unfortunately, they did this at the same time that they decided they were going to release two major new versions of Windows every single year. Mm. And that heightened development process, I think, or sped up development process, whatever you want to call it, I think is a major contributor to this. There just isn't time to find those regressions.
I have to assume Microsoft uses modern software development techniques.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, of course they do. The state of the art,
right.
and which would include testing, of course, at every level as you're writing the code.
You don't think it's like a Z80 best based test suite or something?
No. And I'm sure when they do a build, that as the build part of the build, they run a lot of tests on the code.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So there is internal testing going on.
There is.
There's,
but this is the, it's
but there's
the TSA thing, you know, the
test level that they got to do, obviously.
There's always something that slips through. This version was notable because so many things slipped through. And, you know, they don't say we're sorry, but, you know, we're going to change everything. We're going to fix it. And yeah, you know what? We won't have this problem again for sure. Mm-hmm. But we will have other problems. And it's a methodology thing. It's a, you know, the system is what's not working.
Mm.
And I don't know. I want to be clear. Obviously, I have no idea how they even do things, so how would I know how to fix it? But it's very clear from the outside that what they're doing is not working.
Well, and I'll defend them, because then the other problem really is, and this is unique in some ways to Microsoft, they run on a really bewildering array of hardware.
They do.
that it's not infinite, but virtually infinite combinations of hardware.
Yeah,
and that's hard to test for, too.
They always have. You know,
but it's more all the time, and it's new stuff all the time.
Right, but think about how it was before. Think about this. Like, okay, say back in like Windows Vista, they ran on a lot of different hardware, but it was one operating system every 3 years that you were testing, right? Well, like, so you're testing Windows Vista on everything, but now you're testing, you know, 1603, 1607, 1700, blah, blah. You're going to test all of these different things because people are on all these different versions.
This is the problem they're all making. This is the problem.
It is.
And to Leo's point, you know, the opposite argument to that is, you know, back in the day, you would say something like, well, you know, Apple only has 5% of the PC market. I mean, my God, this thing's a total failure. And you have all these arguments back and forth. Obviously, it's a healthy business. They make a lot of money. But the Apple guys would always say something like, well, yeah, but, you know, we only have this one platform and we do this one thing. Like, you guys have all these different PC makers and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, guys, that was their choice. They could have licensed the operating system. You know, everyone makes their choice. You know, the fact that Windows is more complex because it can run on some crazy number of configurations is a fact, but it's, that was their choice.
Yeah.
You know, they were very successful doing this.
Well, and also, you know, as a testament to how hard this is, Apple, with its very limited number of SKUs, I mean, they know they can test every kind of hardware combination possible, still has showstopper bugs all the time.
Sure.
But so, and I mean, it's not like they're less of a sophisticated operation or anything like that. So,
No, they're not. I look, Windows problems are going to get amplified because of the size of the user base. Sure.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. But, you know, Android's problems are going to be amplified over there.
There's always a new video card, and every video card always has new drivers, and every driver has its own set of bugs. And worse, they've tested, well, we don't have any bugs until we interact with legacy code in Windows 10. And then suddenly, oh, we didn't expect that.
Look, the show is only 2 hours long. We're not going to fix this problem. But
question is, why hasn't Microsoft fixed this problem?
Well, think about, part of the stack, right? They have this thing called Windows Update. Windows Update debuted in XP, if I'm not mistaken, right? Mm-hmm. Windows XP?
Think so.
And, you know, there was a Microsoft Update service up in the cloud, remember, and blah, blah, blah. And at first it was just for Windows, and then eventually it's going to be for all of Microsoft. And eventually what they were going to do is they're going to bring on all these drivers from all the PC makers. And the notion of this one place where you can get everything your PC needs to make sure it's up to date is a really good one. And today, because I review laptops all the time, Lenovo has its own terrible utility. HP has the worst utility I've ever seen for this kind of thing. Dell has their own thing. Everyone has their own little software update utility, and they conflict. Sometimes Windows Update will suggest an Intel display driver update and blah, 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 and then you go to the HP thing. It'll say, no, you want this one over here, and then Microsoft will come back and say, oh, no, you want this one, and they fight with each other. And they don't actually – And then, you know, my computer, which happens to be an HP, I don't mean to dump on HP. I like their stuff, obviously, but the screen goes static basically every day, at least once, like a TV screen at 3 o'clock in the morning back in the 1980s. And it's obviously I believe it's a display driver related problem. This is basic stuff. This should have been fixed a long time ago. God help you if you have like an NVIDIA graphics card and you have that terrible utility that you have to use it never works automatically. You have to step through it. It takes 20 minutes to run. You have to reboot your computer. It's crazy what we have to deal with.
This
stuff should just happen.
I just tried this weekend I hadn't turned it on in like a year, my Acer S7. And I'm like, you know what? I should make sure that's up to date. So I turned it on.
Is it still running Windows 8.1 or something? What's
no, it was thing? Windows 10. I think it was 1607 or maybe 1703, like an older version of Windows.
How long before Windows Update actually displayed something?
Well, wait till you hear this. So it checks Windows Update and it's like, oh, you got a bunch of updates. And so it starts doing it and keeps going. And then like about an hour, I check it and it's in an endless boot loop.
Oh, no.
I'm like,
goodbye.
I know. Wow. And so I'm trying all these different things to get out of it. And so I can get to a command prompt. But after that, I'm like, I don't even know what version of the OS it's running now.
Oh, my God.
Winning. That's so your computer terrible. Did boot is what I heard.
It boots to the command prompt and then, or it reboots when it boots to the.
So you've done the recovery environment thing. And
Paul, we're not going to fix that today.
You're not.
We're not going to fix anything today. Let me be really clear about this. None of this stuff is going to be fixed.
But that goes to the point of so that's a PC from 5 years ago, which technically should be able to run.
Fine. Yeah.
Right? It should work fine.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's because you try to do it all at once.
I just let it do its own thing.
file computers away and then an update happens. You're like, oh, let me update all my computers.
I know.
Yeah. And then it's just this disaster of a room full of machines that can't do anything.
Look at this. This is awesome. Who found this in the chat room? Bry Guy found this in the chat room. It's a Microsoft video on Windows 2000, the largest software development project Microsoft has undertaken in its 20-year history. The team's most important goal is to achieve the highest levels of quality ever seen in a new operating system release. Achieving this goal requires daily, systematic efforts. This is a video on how they do their builds and testing.
The daily cycle for Windows 2000 begins
this is
when
insanity.
The new build is released at 6 p.m. As our testing team
At 6 p.m. and our testing team settling in for the evening servers, like Santa Claus.
Which simulate the
there he is, there's the testing team.
Of thousands of users. With this magnitude of a product, automation is the only way to achieve.
That guy lives on the streets of Seattle now, and he's got a little cup in front of him.
He's got a little permanent twitch.
Focus on refining the more than 10 million lines of testing code that serve as the front line.
Jim Alchin, but who else?
Cutler,
Jim Cutler, maybe.
Yeah, Cutler will never be
at
in this.
5 a.m.
No, he won't.
Remote diagnostics process begins.
I mean, this is the whole classic NT team.
The overnight stress tests are carefully analyzed, then posted on a web page, so that any team member can monitor quantitative results.
It appears to be have been filmed in the 90s somehow.
This is how long ago.
When we're not watching Friends, we're debugging Windows 2000.
Sending every system component assemble to prioritize which bugs get fixed that day.
I mean,
over the next several hours,
this is Windows 2000. Imagine fixes. How crazy it is now.
Any changes, they must compile their code using the most recent build, run functional tests.
There's no Donna Sakar in this group.
For a
I don't think there are any women in this group.
Donna Sakar in this group today. I mean,
it might be
this
one.
Is a completely different thing.
Integration issues to ensure system robustness, as well as a consistent user experience.
This is so
in the meantime,
engineering.
Our hardware labs are busy round the clock, sorting out compatibility issues.
It's an attractive group of people, too.
Oh, yeah, good looking. They spend all night in the lab. And all day in
the bed. Windows 2000, our labs will test 500 LAN adapters, 1,400 printers,
I think I have 500 LAN adapters in my office.
And more probably
than 2,600 modems. Every day, we add more devices to the test matrix.
Oh,
so that
imagine?
By the time we ship Windows 2000, we'll have maximum compatibility coverage. Testing continues.
You know, that is an interesting point, too. They may favor compatibility over reliability.
Plus, I would just like to point out for historians in the group, I don't know if you remember this, but I wrote a story when Windows 2000 came out from a memo from Mark Lukowski that said there were 63,000 potential known bugs
left
in the product in when the it product. Shipped.
Yep.
They were not happy with you about that, as I recall.
Well, they were kind of mad at me on that story.
But I think that's true every time. It's just a secret nobody wants to talk about. But nothing's perfect ever.
That's not true, Leo. NT4 was perfect. I'm going to go back and use that.
This is a great video, Bry Guy. Thank you so much for finding that. That is a great.
It is. There you go. That's pretty awesome.
You must reboot computer for this to take effect. The one thing they've never fixed. Literally exactly the same.
These people would be in their 60s today.
Yeah.
And I think.
And I, honestly, given the work they do, more like their 70s or 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. They look like they're in their 70s.
Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, that's the thing. I'm sure that the people who listen, who work at Microsoft, feel underappreciated. But I think we understand it's a hard job, and it's a higher level problem.
I do understand. But again, the problem, which comes from the top, is that they've never done anything to address the culture that makes this kind of thing possible, not just to continue, but to actually get worse over time.
Yeah.
You know, the issue I have here is that this is something Microsoft should address. They've done things like this every once in a while. Some of the most famous stories about Microsoft are the times when it turned on a dime and went in a different direction. The internet tidal wave is a good example.
Yeah.
The Trustworthy Computing Initiative is an awesome example. The good things
can
happen.
It can be done.
Yes, it can. We have the technology.
Well, presumably.
Maybe not.
We've never proven that this works.
It's kind of amazing complex it is. Well, somewhere something exists that can do this because NASA launches rockets, there are mission critical environments that.
I'm still confused why something hasn't happened in the Windows world. You know, there have been these weird little efforts, like Windows RT was an example of this, or Windows 10S is an example of this, where that you can kind of tell the company understands that they need to get to this future where it's a simpler system. It is something that can be updated the way they're trying to update it now. They need to seed some of this legacy technology out of the core part of the OS, just get it out of there. And how do you do that? And I firmly believe that there is, and they've been working on this for 20 years too. It kills me. Some combination of virtualization and containers of whatever form that would allow you to basically have this thing that's contained that runs that thing you need, which is an app that's like a Win32 app, and you do it on a system that is much simpler and it's more reliable and it's you know, whatever it is. It's just better across the board. And that eventually those things go away. You know, for the people who don't need those particular apps, they just go away. It's kind of like the thing I always said about Windows 10S. If you could just give me Chrome, to give me the one thing, I could pretty much use that system.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, but you know, let's just pretend. But they never, you know, it would be maybe a different thing or a different couple of things for every person. I don't understand how this hasn't evolved in that direction.
Well, I think they were kind of going that direction with Windows Core OS, you know, where they were saying, okay, let's make more commonalities across all these different platforms that we run on, different form factors, different types of operating systems and environments. And now we're not quite sure what's going on with that, you know, but I think it's going to continue. And I think they're looking to kind of keep up leveling that. Maybe that'll help to some degree.
Like how many years ago did Microsoft come up with something called MDOP, which was combination of desktop virtualization and management tools and whatever. This thing probably dates back to Windows Server 2003, maybe timeframe, somewhere in there. And those, you know, I'm forgetting the names of things now, but application virtualization, AppV was one of them. and there was another one. But the idea was you could run either a virtual environment or a virtual app, literally just an app that was delivered from a data center to your computer. It was in a container. You know, it was safe. It's a drag and drop uninstall if you didn't want it. This is like, this is almost 20 years ago. Maybe 20 years is stretching it, but 15 years ago. How has this not happened?
Yeah.
And Leo, you do a Google show. You guys must talk about this Project Fuchsia thing that Google is working on, which, you know, maybe I got this completely wrong, but I sort of see this as their approach to solving this problem for Android, right? They've created this kind of hairball thing, and they want to get people to bring forward the things that matter to them, which are the apps, but they want the system to be better.
Yeah, ground up rewrite. There's other reasons. I mean, they want to get off Oracle.
And Java.
So forth. But I have to think Apple, Microsoft, and Google are all doing ground up rewrites or brand new operating systems. The days are long gone. I mean, we used to get new operating systems from time to time. The days are long gone when you get new operating systems.
They are.
I guess that makes sense. But a ground up rewrite often is the, you know, refactor the whole thing, start over and look and the big take the lessons though, that you've learned, plus make it modern.
When Microsoft was working on NT next to Windows, the one thing we wouldn't have said about that system, the new one, NT, was that it was smaller, lighter, used less RAM.
Right, because you didn't need to in those days. The curve was up, up, up.
The curve was always up. These days, I feel like it's in the opposite direction, right? That we can, when needed, run these heavy things from the past. But what we really want most of the time is something that's thin and light and secure and reliable.
There's an infinitude of new criteria for a good operating system. The ability to run on a variety of hardware, security, you know, first. I mean, you could think of a lot of things that you didn't do in Android or Windows that you would say, oh, no, we got to... I mean, that's true of everything. I once asked Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the internet.
Al Gore?
No, not Al Gore.
Oh, the other one.
The guy in the suits. I once asked him, what would you have done differently? He said, I'd have built encryption in from day one. He created TCP/IP.
Yeah.
And so in hindsight, it's easy to see, oh, yeah, we should have done this, but we didn't know. So there is, I mean, you can make a strong case. It's just that an operating system is a hard thing to write. And Fuchsia's been in progress for 5 years I mean, it's a long process. Vince Cerf, thank you.
They did see the need for this. What I mean is, I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet. I don't think the guys that designed NT or whatever would have thought this back in 1993. Yeah.
But even NT wasn't really ground up, right?
No, Microsoft was building one. Midori, remember that whole thing? Right. That was like a non-Windows OS they were building.
It was abandoned, right?
Sure. Abandoned after 10 years. Yep.
I think
we're going to wake up one day and they're going to be running elementary OS and it's going to have some Windows application compatibility
Microsoft developed. It's going to be an open source kernel and an open source operating system. Yeah. It won't be Windows.
And that Microsoft would agree.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter at this point. Microsoft realizes no matter what you do, it's operating system agnostic. So... Mm-hmm. Make it open source, but that way everybody can bang on it, work on it.
You could almost
put it
make
on
the
GitHub.
Actually
put it on GitHub.
They'd be better. Well, you know, Microsoft brings their apps to mobile, right? So this is some kind of first step in this direction. Mm-hmm. Maybe Microsoft making their own client OS from whole cloth doesn't make any sense at this point. Maybe that ship has literally sailed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? I think there's, in my mind, this is exactly what happens when you have closed source proprietary software developed by one company, is eventually it collapses in on itself. It's just can't, it's not sustainable.
If something called Windows 11 came out and it was actually Linux, but it had the Windows 10 user experience and was completely compatible with Win32 apps and store apps, what would the difference be from the point of view of a user?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the world we're moving to, which is a cloud-based OS agnostic environment.
I'm not even sure that they'll do something like that. But it is interesting that they went Linux for this Azure Sphere thing,
yeah.
Right? Which
but
was
it made
a pretty
sense.
Explicit. Yeah, but an admission, by the way, you mentioned OneCore, for example. The point of OneCore was that it was this system that could scale across every conceivable device type. Well, guess what? It can't scale down to that little thing, you know, which is the these little AI capable
sensors,
what are they called? Computing units, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
In some ways,
.NET Core. You could look at that as the operating system, right? And they're making sure that goes cross-platform.
I almost used .NET as an example of one of the times when Microsoft turned on a dime, although technically that one didn't pan out in that way exactly. But there was a moment in time, 2000-ish, right, where the whole company was pivoting around .NET, for sure.
Yep.
Let me read the description of Fuchsia, which, by the way, is only... at least appeared publicly in 2016, so it's only a few years old. Fuchsia is a capability-based, that's interesting, operating system being developed by Google. It's open source. It has a new kernel, not a Linux kernel. It's the kernel called Zircon. Mm-hmm. It's capable of running on everything from embedded systems to smartphones to tablets to personal computers.
It's one core.
One core, yep. And it's open source, which I think is important because I think you'd be crazy to make a closed source operating system at this point.
Yeah, it also means it can't be developed in a completely skunkworks type way where
secretly,
all
right.
of a sudden one day, surprise, right. we're doing this thing.
Well, that's why we know about it, right? It appeared on GitHub in 2016, mm-hmm. August 2016.
Yep.
So I think it's very interesting. Zircon is a new microkernel derived from Little Kernel, which is a small OS intended for embedded systems.
You know what? I don't mean to. I'm sorry. I literally have never really thought in my head about this Linux thing before. But the truth is, Microsoft has already done what I described. That's what NT was. In fact, we just watched a video for Windows 2000. That was Windows NT 5.0. That transition from a completely different code base, which is what they did, and a 16/32-bit code base for DOS and Windows, classic Windows, right? Windows 3, whatever, to NT. Those are completely different platforms. In fact, the way NT was architected in the beginning, at least, it could support multiple what they called personalities. There was going to be an OS2 personality. There was a POSIX personality. Mm-hmm. There was a Windows personality.
Wow.
And guess which one won the personality contest?
You'll appreciate this. The kernel that was the beginnings of the Zircon kernel for Fuchsia, Paul, was written by a guy named Travis Geiselbrecht, who is in Seattle, who was the guy who started the BOS kernel.
BOS is a joke.
So
that's
BOS,
amazing.
He's the
BOS
cousin.
Guy.
It's a cousin.
I literally,
of BOS.
That was in my head.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
That was the last great operating system that just never happened. BOS.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Everybody used it, loved it. It was clean. Mm-hmm. It was very solid. It was very interesting.
I'm surprised it didn't turn into a Linux distribution.
I am too.
You know.
He worked at B, and so when B died, he started new OS, which was his kind of compatible version of the BOS. I suspect similar in design. He's also worked at Jawbone, Palm, Apple, and Danger.
Wow.
This guy's an interesting guy.
Yeah.
So, Travis, get to work.
get going on this.
We need a new OS.
You probably, this is semi-related to this, but the guy who started Siri, which was its own company when Apple bought them in 2010 or something, is the guy behind Bixby at Samsung.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the other.
I just found this out.
Yeah, no.
I didn't know this.
Yeah, you could have asked me. So the story is that they wrote Siri as a standalone third-party app for iPhone, which Apple bought. He stayed there briefly, then created something called Viv.ai, left Apple to create Viv AI, which Samsung purchased.
Yes.
And Bixby originally was not Viv AI. Bixby was a separate project at Samsung that was designed really mostly to voice control the internals of the phone, launch programs and stuff. And now as they add more Siri-like or Google Home-like features, they're incorporating, it seems to be they're incorporating Viv.
There's an interview with this gentleman. I don't. What's his name?
There's several. I don't remember his name off the
top. Okay, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But one of the guys from that company. And he was talking about the whole Samsung thing. He says that the thing he regrets the most about the Apple acquisition was that they didn't insist on it being an open system. That this thing, if you think about the capabilities, like what Amazon calls skills for a personal digital assistant, being an open market like an app store, that's what makes that thing successful. And that it was crazy to him that Apple didn't understand that since they had started the app, you know, the app store.
Mm-hmm. Yep. He was. Mm-hmm. I think so they were a little pissed, frankly.
Apple didn't handle it very well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when they went to Samsung, they were like, look, the only way this is going to happen is if you make this thing an open ecosystem. And they agreed to do it. Now, it took them, I think, a year or two or whatever. Yeah. But that's what they're doing right now. And I've always sort of dismissed Bixby as kind of an also-ran in the sense that it's late to market compared to the other digital assistants we see. It's maybe superfluous in some ways because we already have so many digital personal assistants. But the fact that these people are involved with it actually makes me slightly more interested in this thing.
Dag Kitlaus and Adam Chire. I don't know which one you saw in an interview.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But they left Apple, founded Viv, were acquired by Samsung, and now presumably are working on it.
I hope that their tagline was, you haven't lived until you've Viv'd.
somebody in the chat room is saying, nobody's talking about it, but Bixby's gotten really good. I haven't, that's Hell's Kitchen NYC. I haven't...
It could be.
Yeah. I mean, I have the Bixby button, but I don't dare push it on my Note 9, you know.
Oh, yeah. Right.
In fact, when I push it, it says, okay, you want to set up Bixby? No!
That's probably the state that thing is in on most people's phones, where it's in. It's asking you to set it up. And you just, you
please
know, it's
set me up.
You're like, no.
Set me up, please.
Anyway, this has been a fascinating conversation that in no way has anything to do with the notes that we created today.
Oh, yeah.
Which is too bad. But
you want to go on with those? Because we got to finish the 1809 stuff here.
It's kind of, but it's interesting to me that this thing could kind of organically happen because literally we are living in this hellhole of 1809, just like never-ending Groundhog Day kind of thing. And this is where... the mind goes when you're under this kind of attack.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just say the natural thing. There must be a better way.
Right.
There's got to be a better way. Yes. Is this the new normal for every...
I know.
That would be bad. Every feature release, that would be
bad. That would not be good. No.
No, you know what? This one is going up much more slowly than previous ones have, surprise. And I'm sure they're going to get it right. I'm sure, you know, yes, there are problems, obviously, but they're not going to deliver it to the computers that have those things that would cause the problems. That's good.
I mean, you got to think Microsoft's looking at this and saying, what can we do better? I guess what we'd like to hear, and I don't know why they haven't said something more forthright, is what they're planning to do.
Well,
maybe they don't want to admit it, right?
They will.
They did that blog post when 1809 came back out, and it was so weird because it was like, we think we're doing a great job.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait, what?
But it is just... you know, it's like the Baghdad Bob thing. Like, we're doing fine. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Right.
As the U.S. tanks are like rolling behind them in the video.
I mean, if you remember that blog post they did, they kind of hinted in the last paragraph, like, we know there are problems and we're working on it. So there was like one kind of glimmer of hope, like, hey, they're going to do something, but they didn't do it yet. And we don't know what it is. No, it was just like 2,000 words, right? And you're going through it and you're like, wait, they think everything's great. They think they're doing great. And then you get to the end and it's like, yeah, we know there have been some problems. I'm like, finally, okay, they admit it, you know?
As veterans of the Sanofsky era, you and I are both very adept at looking at a 2,000-word post and boiling it down to the important
one sentence.
You know, the one or two sentences.
The one that we need. Yeah.
I believe that... they will, and you know, I'm surprised they haven't yet, but start discussing some of their plans for improving the quality of Windows for sure. Right. I think that's something they've kind of said.
They have to. They have to say something.
Yeah. Communication, you know, it's fundamental.
Just to be for completeness sake, the media player scroll thing doesn't work. You can't install 1809 on PCs with certain Intel video drivers.
Yep.
I don't know what that means.
The PC Maker and Windows are kind of fighting each other on the
compatibility issue, presumably, right? Mm-hmm.
On the version of the driver. And in some cases, what Microsoft is saying is, if you don't take the one we told you to take, we're not giving you the next version of Windows. Yeah. This is a stupid problem, but yeah.
But one we're glad to have. And then the iCloud bug, the cloud bug is fixed. What's the, is it iCloud?
Yeah, so what's the iCloud client for Windows. Yeah, we all use this, you know, because we all sync our stuff to Apple servers.
Nobody uses that.
It's, you know, iCloud has a client. It's just like Dropbox or OneDrive or whatever. And there was a sync issue with the latest version. So they upgrade, you know, they just updated. It's fine. So it works now. Basically, it was reporting that you didn't have a supported version of Windows if you had 1809. Now it works and it syncs properly.
Good. So that's it.
Yesterday Microsoft pushed out cumulative updates full of all kinds of fixes and patches for a bunch of flavors of Windows 10. So they did it for 1803, 1709, 1703, and 1607, and they have KBs for each of those. 67. The one that didn't get it was 1809, but instead what they did, which is interesting because I don't think they usually do this, is they pushed the cumulative update for 1809 to the release preview ring instead of out to mainstream customers for testing before it goes to the mainstream customers.
This is a group of people who have touched the fire twice now, and they're not going to make that mistake again.
So I think they're not going to do it again.
One of the big complaints about 1809, the original release back on October 3 or whatever date that was that they had never put it in the release preview ring, which is the normal way of things. It's kind of like the new release candidate. Mm-hmm. They went directly from slow ring to production, and all hell broke loose.
Although, you know, it was funny. I don't know if you saw this, Paul. In all those cumulative updates they released yesterday and pushed out to all the different flavors of Windows 10, now everyone has the media player bug. It got introduced as part of that cumulative update.
I love this company. I just want to reflect briefly on the wonderful career we've been given covering Microsoft and their many adventures.
Thank you. Thank you.
But did you guys look at this list of what is in the cumulative update for 1809?
Yeah.
Okay, so it went to the release preview. There are like, I don't know, 40 fixes listed here. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're fixing a lot of things that aren't even listed by many people when they're talking about problems with it. Although they are going to fix that Win32 file association bug and the map drives bug with this.
So my guess on that is that two things. One, I think in the process of looking for the problems that were reported, they found other things, right?
Yeah.
But right. I also think that they went back and said, look, how did we miss this stuff? We know people reported it. Mm-hmm. Is there other stuff like this? And I think they found about 40 of them. I think that's what that is. You know, probably more than 40, but those are maybe the worst ones, are the ones they can fix this month.
Yeah.
Maybe this is part of this quality thing they were talking about. You know, we'll see something like this, well, I guess in December now, January, February, as we go forward, you might see maybe 2 or 3 months of this kind of thing, right? And I can't complain about this. This is what I've been asking for years, for someone to kind of step back and finish the job, you know, to actually look at the little niggling things that have been sitting out there, never been fixed.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, Leo, several people have asked on Twitter if you guys can share the link to that Windows 2000 video.
Oh, people want to see it. Yeah, I can say it out loud, but it's, you know, it's one of those YouTube links.
Right.
Yeah, that's you know what, I should, let's see, let me go back and find it. It was in the chat room.
You could email it to one of us and we could put it on Twitter.
Yeah. Let's find Bry Guys.
Yeah, because a couple people are asking, I see.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool. I had never seen that video before.
Awesome stuff. This YouTube has such amazing stuff on it.
They do.
I agree. I've recommended this to Mary Jo. With regards to this OS stuff, if you haven't done it, we talked about the Dave Cutler two-part series, you know, from the Computer History Museum that's on YouTube. There's a similar video, or set of videos like that, from Avi Tavanian. This is must watch. Information. It's incredible. And one of the most interesting things he talks about is their move to Intel processors and how, you know, Apple kind of made it look like they did this overnight when in fact they had been compiling on Intel for several years by that point and had been anticipating that this would happen someday. It's fascinating and really worth watching. Mm. And also, by the way, a hint at how easy it will be for Apple to switch to their A-series processors on the Mac, because you know they have been now doing that for several years.
Mm-hmm. If you Google YouTube the daily cycle Windows 2000, you will find it. The daily cycle Windows 2000.
Okay,
It's actually, will you find it?
I got it.
Did you? Okay.
I think, although we got it in Spanish.
Yes. No, it's not in Spanish. It's post. That's the one. It's posted by somebody.
Okay. There it is.
In Spanish. Yep. But the video itself is in English. Yeah. No, that's the one. You got it.
Okay.
I could give you the long URL.
No, I got it.
Yeah.
Yep. There it is. I got it.
And thank I don't, you. As you know, have a Twitter account. So
no, I know. So we'll take care of it
about that. It's from Ciclo Diario de Desenvolvimento na Microsoft, which is why it's not pulled down probably because no one's found it yet.
Right.
It's a YouTube channel just called FB, which has a bunch of random videos.
It's like Outlook Express was in the video, formerly Internet Mail and News.
You know, I'm sure it'll get pulled down immediately. So download it.
It's awesome.
It's awesome.
Get it now.
It's awesome. I mean, I don't know who it was prepared for even. It's probably the best look at the testing process from that era. And if you look at the screens carefully, right, you probably could figure out some more stuff. It is an official Microsoft video.
Okay, got it.
Copyright 1999, Microsoft. let's take a break, and when we come back, more great stuff, including I'd like to get Paul and Mary Jo's take on the Supreme Court case that was heard on Monday against Apple for
we opine on many Supreme Court cases, so this will be not unusual for people.
More opining from our court observers. I have an answer for people who are asking the question, what do I get my favorite person for Hanukkah or Christmas? You know, I need to get a gift, or in my case, birthday tomorrow. My case. Actually, you don't get me a slide belt because I already have many slide belts. Slide belts are beautiful. I'm a big slide belt fan from Brig Taylor. I stopped wearing belts, as I think a lot of people did, because there's a little problem with the belt. They were basically invented in the Middle Ages. Take this strap of leather, punch some holes in it, and that should succeed in holding thy girdle in place. But the problem is my girdle it varies in size, and those holes just don't really do it. Either they're so loose my pants fall down, or it's too tight to breathe. Slide belt solves that problem. Here's my favorite slide belt. This is a beautiful top grain leather strap, although they come in vegan, even canvas straps. And here's the slide belt buckle. This one's engraved Twit, but you could engrave it with, I guess there's probably room for four, maybe five letters on it. Initials would be nice. Company names. If you've got this would be a great groomsman's gift if you've got a wedding coming up. So the strap and the buckle come separate, and I'll show you there's a very good reason for that. These are interchangeable. So you can have, you know, get one engraved buckle and use it on a variety of straps, depending on whether you were formal or more casual. But all of the belts have the same patented ratchet mechanism. I don't know how well you can see those notches. There's 32 settings, so ranging in about 8 inches. So you have really an 8-inch variable. So you can all have all the turkey you want and still have room to fit in your pants. Here's what you do when you get the belt. You cut it to length. It goes all the way up to 48 inches. I would cut mine down to 40. You pick. So you trim that off. And then you stick the end in the slide belt buckle, which has a very good, strong grip once you lock that in. That is not going anywhere. But it's easy to unlock, so you can put a new one in. And now I'm going to show you how the belt sounds. So when you put on your slide belt, you slide it in here. And it's, you know, just like a regular belt, except instead of finding that one hole that's closest to your actual waist size, you ratchet it in to just the right size. Ooh, I like this. It's silent. If you like to expand a little bit, no one will know you're expanding unless you go too far, and then you have to ratchet it in a little bit more. Slide belts are practical, but they're also fun. They're beautiful. So this is the leather with the gunmetal. Actually, that's a vegan strap. Boy, it looks like leather. They do have top grain leather and full grain leather. This is a canvas strap with the brushed kind of brass, antique brass buckle. They have a whole variety. Here's what you do. Go to slidebelts, plural, .com/twit. And if you use the code TWIT at checkout, you can get 20% off your order. So here's, I know Black Friday's over, even Cyber Monday, but hey, the sale goes on at Slide Belts by Brig Taylor. Slidebelts.com/twit, offer code TWIT. I should mention there's also a gift tab on the website, some really nice gift sets. Those have very good offers, but the discount doesn't apply to them because they're already heavily discounted. They also now offer watches with swappable watch bands, which is kind of cool. Really a great gift for this holiday season. From unisex belts to colorful belts for kids to skinny belts for women. And don't forget, my personal favorite. I already have one. You don't have to gift me one. The Slide Belt Survival Belt. Let me show you this one. This is awesome. This belt buckle, a perfectly innocuous belt buckle, but don't try to wear it on an airplane because it has a very sharp knife on it, a bottle opener. It also has built in a LED flashlight. You can pop it right out there. That's actually quite bright. You could definitely get your way around the woods with that, and a fire starter. So you could you could build a fire. You will literally use this for survival. Should, like Lost, your plane crash on a desert island, you'll be glad you're wearing the Slide Belts Survival Belt. And that's a great gift, too, for groomsmen. or maybe the groom should have. I think the groom should have that. Carry less, adventure more. Slidebelts.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT for 20% off your order. Slidebelts.com/twit. Offer code TWIT. Winter weight gain will do nothing in the face of Slide Belt winter weight gain. Paul, load on with the carbohydrates. The slide belts await.
Oh, that party's
over. Eat all that gravy.
Eat all that gravy, my friends.
I could drink gravy through a straw, but the stuffing is done.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. All right. On we go with the show. Actually, before we get to Apple, let's talk about, I almost don't even want to bring this
more
up.
Windows 10.
Windows 10 19H1.
No, this seems to be going better.
Oh, good.
1809.
Hallelujah.
Right. So 19H1 is the next version of Windows 10, the next feature update after the October update. And so right now, Microsoft is continuing to roll out basically almost weekly builds of this to the fast ring. One just came out right before the show. And there's not a lot of brand new features or anything major in it, but they're doing what we were hoping they would do, which is some more fit and finish and, you know, tweaking some of the settings around things like, you know, setting the clocks and date and time and how startup menus display, that kind of stuff. Yeah. So it kind of made me wonder, what if 19H1 is just going to be a minor update that focuses on fit and finish? I don't think that would be
Shut
bad.
Shut your mouth.
Do you think it would?
Brilliant idea. Brilliant. Are you kidding?
Honestly, the last two releases were much like that, right?
Yeah.
Although, well, we thought 1809 Sets was. Is probably going to appear again.
I wonder. You know, yeah. What? I wonder, because Sets has not reappeared, and the bug bash, the first bug bash for this starts in January.
Yeah. I would support that for sure. I mean, this is, you know, I feel like I've been beating this to death for about 8 years now, but this is something they've needed to do for a long time. So that would be welcome.
I keep thinking, okay, now that the Windows engineering group is inside of Jason Zander's organization, which is where Azure is and Windows Server, I'm like, okay, somebody there must be saying to these guys, okay, let's get this under control, right?
The assumption, yeah.
So maybe it's happening. Although, I'll tell you, okay, on the server side, I don't know if you noticed this, but right before Thanksgiving, the first Windows Server build of 19H1 came out. Mm-hmm. They didn't even announce it. There was no blog post. There was no fanfare. I only found out about it because Neowen found it. And I'm like, oh, there's the first server build. And so then you go through all the links and you can see, you can download it. Testers can start working with it. And there's absolutely nothing about what's in it anywhere. Like, it's just like, yeah, right. The server builds out. And there's no list of features or anything anywhere. And I asked Microsoft and they said, yeah, we don't really have anything to say about it right now.
Maybe they'll make a little video called The Daily Cycle where they talk about how, you know, Windows Server 19H1 or whatever it's going to be called. We'll just, yeah. It will be better in every way.
Right. I don't know. It's curious that there's nothing.
How many modems do they test against this thing now?
Sorry?
How many modems do they test against?
Right. More than 500, probably.
2,600 Hayes-compatible modems were tested that's right. in the production.
Yep. Yeah, so it's server build 18282, which is the same number as client from like 2 weeks ago. So they're right. in lockstep again with them. But
yeah. I'd love them.
Yeah. all right. Enough about Windows. Let's talk about Apple.
Finally.
I've been waiting all week. So there's really two stories here. The story, just to clarify this, by the way, I think Ben Thompson at Stratechery does a pretty good write-up on this. But just to clarify, the Supreme Court is not hearing the case whether Apple is a monopoly.
Right. They're hearing whether they want to hear the case.
Yeah. issue is a class action lawsuit filed like in 2011. Right. Saying that the App Store is a monopolist and that prices are higher because of Apple's price fixing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem is that the courts have said, no, you know, you don't have standing. You can't sue Apple unless you particularly overpaid for an app. And this goes back to a decision from 1977 called Illinois Brick, which has a great name, in which the Supreme Court held that the state of Illinois couldn't sue the brick makers who were colluding to set prices because they weren't buying the bricks. Only people who were actually buying the bricks could sue. You had to, and that's the legal term.
Yeah, in other words, Apple is isolated because they're
Apple
not
says,
selling apps directly.
We don't sell apps. We are merely passing along, you know, a store. Mm-hmm. Commit, you know, so. Mm-hmm. I guess the Supreme Court will kind of rule on that. The question before the Supreme Court is, can this class action lawsuit proceed? Do the people suing have standing? Or do they have to sue I don't know what it is.
Well, but the problem is, first of all, there's no price fixing that's occurring.
Well, Apple says you can't end a price with anything but 99, and the lowest price you can set is 99 cents. It also takes a 30% commission. So the lawsuit, the class action suit says, well, because that 30% commission, software developers are going to pass that along to end users. So Apple is effectively increasing the cost of apps.
So the price would have been 69 cents?
I guess.
Yeah.
You know,
and doesn't everybody do it? Like Microsoft does it too.
Everybody does it.
Well, that's the thing.
So does Walmart.
Everyone does it, right? And what we don't have is an example of a situation where there's a platform like the Mac would be one example, or Android would be an example, where app developers actually do charge more for the same app on the store than they do when they sell it directly to the consumer. The problem is that, you know, Apple can point to 200 billion apps delivered, whatever the numbers are, you know, some millions and millions of dollars given to developers. What they've done is created a huge opportunity for developers here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I look at this through the lens of the stuff that Microsoft underwent. And you look at the claims of monopoly that were made against Microsoft, which I think were accurate, and the charges of illegal business practices, which were absolutely accurate, where you take advantage of a monopoly to force other products on your customers. And, you know, changes were made. And I don't really see that in the Apple ecosystem. I mean, that could be changing, maybe. You could look at it something like Apple Music, for example, which is kind of pushed incessantly on people who are in the ecosystem. And there are certain things you can only do with Apple Music that you can't do with Spotify, let's say. But the fact remains that Spotify is available. I think the bigger if there is an issue I have with Apple in the App Store, it's that someone like a Microsoft or a Dropbox or a Spotify has to give them 30% of any revenues that are derived from the app. So if someone goes to Apple's App Store and says, I want to get Microsoft Word, and they're like, you can get this, but this thing is actually better if you have an Office 365 subscription. And they're like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll pay for that. And you pay the $69 or the $99. 30% of that goes to Apple too, if you do that from the app. It's the reason that the Amazon Kindle app doesn't have the store in it on iOS only. Because if they sold you a book, they'd have to give 30% of those proceeds to Apple. That's a problem. But I don't think we have examples. I don't think there are developers out there complaining like, my God, this 30% vig is killing us. Like you've just given people a market of a billion, enthusiastic users. I don't know. I don't see it.
I agree. I feel like what Google did is more predatory than what Apple's doing, in terms of requiring other companies to take parts of their apps and their infrastructure. If you want to, use Google operating systems.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No doubt about it. Yep.
But Apple's not doing that. I mean, they don't let people do that.
Well, Apple doesn't have the other choice. I mean, right. Apple just sells their own stuff. And it's the same as, what they did with the Mac.
I feel like you could just say to somebody who says it's predatory or anti-competitive, well, you've got Android, you've got Windows, you've got other platforms.
That's always
you don't like what Apple's doing.
Yeah. There are behaviors that are perfectly fine when you're small that are illegal when you have a monopoly. You may not like it as a user that you can't change the default browser to Chrome on an iPhone. You may not like that. It's fine. I don't like it. But the iPhone is 13% of the smartphone market. You have a choice. You have a lot of choices if you want to go Android. I mean, if you're really hell-bent on running Chrome as your default browser, if this is the meaningful thing for you, well, you absolutely have a choice. They've created this own little thing for themselves. You don't have to, you don't have to be part of it. I don't think they own a monopoly. I don't think Apple has ever owned a monopoly with the possible exception of the iPod, which peaked and then disappeared because of smartphones. Mm-hmm. Yep. And if you look at everything else they do, I don't see a monopoly anywhere.
Well, that was an easy solution.
Well, what about you, Leo, though? Like, what do you think about
this? What do you think?
I don't know.
Remember, first of all, do you think that will the Supreme Court even hear this case?
Well, they are hearing it. They heard it on Monday.
Well, will they, in fact, rule on it?
They will rule. The question is what they will rule. And it seemed to be from the questioning that they were kind of on Apple's side, which means they would say, no, this is... But... The real question is for the Supreme Court is, does Illinois brick hold here? And there is some thought, and some of the justices seem to think that times have changed. Illinois brick does not hold here. And that would actually be a more sweeping change legally for other things. Now, even if the Supreme Court lets this class action suit go ahead, it's going to be years before it's resolved. Class action suits are dopey because nobody makes any money on them except the lawyers. And we all know that because we've all received postcards that say, here's your nickel.
Yeah.
Oh, I got a couple of bucks from Amazon, but yeah.
For sure. I got a bag of Pop Chips once.
So better than most Indiegogo campaigns.
Yeah. Honestly, class action lawsuits are filed by lawyers, not by individuals. Should Apple be forced to open the App Store is an interesting question. Android does open its App Store, but they do it. You have to go into settings. They warn you. They say, yeah, you can install third-party apps. But remember, that's how Windows works. Windows allows you to install third-party apps. The version of Windows that doesn't, Windows 10S, the first thing Paul Thurrott does is turn it off. Because you want to install third-party apps. Right?
Yes.
So you, at least on a desktop system, prefer
an
open system.
Actually,
So the argument that Apple's made it more secure by having a curated app store kind of flies in the face of that. Yeah, Microsoft could make Windows more secure by having a curated app store, but they don't.
The app store
nobody wants it.
if Apple's App Store had 117 apps of it and 11 of them are fart apps, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right? This would be, this platform wouldn't make any sense. The point is Apple created a successful platform for apps. It's successful for users. It's successful for developers. There's competition. You know, those fart apps, or 11 of them, or whatever the number is, you know, some of them are paid. Well, yeah, guess what? People are going to, you know, make the choice.
Yeah, but, okay, so I'll give you the arguments. If you're Amazon and you put a Kindle app in the App Store, you're prohibited by Apple from allowing people to buy books in the Kindle app. Mm. Actually, you're not prohibited. Apple will take its 30%. Right. So that's, I would call that what they call rent seeking, which is without adding value, Apple takes a 30% commission. You can argue they add value for the Kindle app download because they're hosting it and marketing. But you cannot argue that they add value to book sales in the Kindle app. So that 30 or the or movie subscriptions in the Netflix app. So that 30% would be pure rent taking, and that to me is the problem. Now,
but that's not part of the class action.
Well, no, it is, because the class action would break Apple's monopoly. So they would say third-party. If they win the class action suit, then Apple will be forced to allow third-party apps to install.
I look at this from a sounds overly simplistic. It's almost like a right-wrong thing, a consumer harm kind of a thing.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly how our panel at MacBreak Weekly was looking at it. From the point of view of a consumer,
Mary Jo mentioned
the App Store is a good thing.
Google's actions with regards to Android licensing have created a situation that is onerous for lots of people in the chain and ultimately harms competition and thus consumers. So, for example, someone like, you know, Amazon is interesting because they sell these tablets and they're based on these crazy, terrible chipsets, and they have their own kind of weird version of Android and everything. And they can't go to Samsung or one of the major makers. They can't go to Qualcomm and say, we want to use your chips, because you can't sell a device that runs on this non-Android thing and sell what they already sell. So they're kind of stuck with this crappy, you know, small set of people they can work with. And that's kind of half the reason their tablets are terrible. But, you know, the hope here is that through this antitrust stuff in Europe, that Google will be forced to change the way that Android is licensed. It's not going to really change the market situation because Android's already entrenched. But that the result is that we'll see some interesting new choices down the road. And one of the things, and applying that to the Apple thing, this notion that app developers are charging like an extra 30% maybe, because that's what Apple charges them, I don't think there's any evidence of that. But the thing that you and I both talked about, the notion that Amazon can't or won't, because it's just too expensive, sell books through their Kindle app, is confusing to consumers. Like, I'm sure most people are like, where's the store? Like, what's going on here? You know, it's a goofy thing. Like, people who own these devices know you have to go to a website. You can order it. You can send it to your iPhone. You know, Amazon's done what they can to make it easier. But Apple has really made it hard on Amazon to do business on this very popular device. And I think that kind of thing is absolutely a problem. I've always thought that.
Well, this is related. This is Apple doing some rent taking based on the fact that they require 30% commission on everything sold through the App Store. So
I just
Paul, you turn off Windows 10S, right? You want to be able to buy.
Let me give you two examples from the desktop, because I've been using a MacBook Air. I'm going to review the new MacBook Air. I've looked at the Mac App Store, which is, you know, kind of crappy, but actually, not as bad as the Windows App Store, but whatever. And I've seen a few examples of paid apps in there that I've researched on the web to see if you could get them separately. And you can. In fact, I think in almost every case, they've always been the same price, right? And these are not Adobe apps or high, you know, expensive company. They're like little Bob, you know, mom and pop type stores. On the Windows side, the only really good example I can think of is Adobe Photoshop Elements, which is usually the same or less expensive, I think, in the store, depending on whether or not it's on sale, than it is buying it out in the world, you know, like on the web. You actually get better licensing terms when you get it through the store. I've been able to install that app on every computer I've ever owned. It's no problem at all. But when I was buying that from Adobe, which I've done many times, You can install it on, in the beginning it was one computer, and then eventually it was two. And if God help you, if you forgot to decouple the license from the machine and you wiped out Windows, which is something I've done tons of times, you're on the phone with Adobe saying, could you please free up this license for this thing I paid for? And so this is kind of anecdotal for sure, but in situations where the apps are available outside the store and inside of a store, both on the Mac and on Windows, I'd have to say, honestly, there is either no harm at all to getting the store version or it's better. So I don't have examples on Android. I'm not really aware of anything like that on Android.
There, you know, the example on Android that's germane is Fortnite.
Yeah, which is only available outside of the store.
And that's why, because and what was it, Blizzard? I can't remember.
Epic.
Epic, that's it. The creators of Fortnite decided we don't want to give 30% VIG rent-seeking to Google for putting it in the Play Store. Actually, it's not rent-seeking because you get some marketing benefit. They host the download. There's some security, so there's some value to it. But they decided we didn't want to give them 30%. And because they couldn't do this on iOS. You have to sell it in the App Store. Mm. But they made the economic decision to sell it outside the App Store. And on Android, you can. There's a little switch, and you can say, yeah, for just this once, I'd like to download Fortnite directly from Epic.
The guy who runs Epic is an insane person. He's always been anti-store. He spent years going after Microsoft for the Windows Store because he was sure that what Microsoft was going to do was kill Steam and all this third-party stuff. Mm. And the goal was to centralize everything around. He's a conspiracy nut.
They're reasonable, but regardless. And there are good arguments why this was a bad idea for Fortnite, including the fact that the download was hijacked.
They would have sold just as many if it was in the store.
They probably would have sold many. Would they have sold 30% more? Probably. But
we'll never know, probably,
honestly.
He made
an economic decision, which I think was, the point is, was his right to do. And because Google does not monopolize the store, he could make that decision.
I agree with that.
He could not make that, was not available to him in iOS.
So, have you installed Fortnite on an Android phone?
No.
Have you done it?
No.
Yeah, Leo?
No. I have.
You have?
You what?
No.
Are you serious?
I can do it right now. Is it a pain in the butt?
You know, it's not frictionless. Yeah, I guess, you know, I'm not saying it's worth the 30% to be able to click an install button and have it just work, but because it's a little more complex than that. But honestly, you do have to jump through some hoops to make that thing happen.
Yeah, but
I hear you.
Shouldn't it be their right to decide whether they want to sell in store or not?
It's Apple's right as the platform maker to decide how or if apps get on their platform in the first place. I mean, in an open system, Epic can look at it and say, you know, we're going to go this other route. And on iOS, which is not an open system, they don't have a choice, and so they go the store route. I just think that's the natural order of things. It's fine. I respect the fact that they chose what they chose, I guess. I actually don't think it was the right choice on Android.
But the fact that they had the choice is the point. And the same reason, the fact that you can download Chrome on Windows, even though it's not available in the Windows Store, that's the point. Is that a store? Well, is that a monopoly via the App Store? To me, I understand the security benefits. I do, and that's why this is difficult, because you get a security benefit on iOS because you can only install it from the store. You would also, Microsoft claims, get a security benefit on Windows 10S.
Yeah, but we need to not worry about that.
But it's exactly.
Let's not worry about that part of it. I think
it's exactly related, though. It's the same thing.
Well, no, but I think the important aspect here is just the monopoly aspect of it. In other words, regardless of the benefits of the store, is there some form of harm that occurs to consumers or to developers because they don't have the option to get apps outside of the store?
There clearly is. So, but here's the question for you. Let's say the same exact case was against Microsoft.
Yep.
Let's say Windows 10S was the only version of Windows 10 you could get.
Yeah, sure. What a world. We wouldn't be doing this podcast later, but continue.
My point exactly. And this case where somebody, some class action lawsuit filed by some guy named Thorat in the lower Mukunji Valley, who said, well, this isn't right. You shouldn't be able to monopoly. You shouldn't force a monopoly on the App Store. I should be able to put apps on my device from any source.
Yeah.
Now,
first of all, that business model wouldn't be viable on Windows. So the reason the Supreme Court is involved in this is that iOS is a tremendously successful platform, and their app store is unbelievably successful, right? And this complicates matters because showing consumer harm is a little hard when it works so well. You know, I
also feel like on Windows, it wouldn't be, it still wouldn't be a case.
Right. I actually think the fact that so many others have emulated Apple's model, including the, you know, the dominant platform, although I agree that obviously you can install apps outside of the store.
Yeah, I think Android's did it right, which is it's not the default, but you have a Switch, just like Windows 10S. It's not, you know, you have a Switch. Actually, they do it better than Windows 10S because it's an all or nothing thing on 10S. But on Android, when you flip the Switch that says, yeah, I want Fortnite, on most Android,
I'm an Android
installs,
user,
it turns itself back on. It says, okay, for this one time, I'm going to let you download this.
I think there's a difference between, like, did it, like, right and did it in a way that I prefer. You know, like, in my worldview, I agree with you. I like the fact that this can happen. I did install Fortnite this way because it's the only way I can do it. I would have preferred doing it in the store. I have installed, I would say, I guess on every phone probably, I've at one point turned on that developer feature where you can install sideload apps. And I've installed things that way. I've done this. There's a Pixel style launcher I recommended a couple months ago that required you to do this, for example, because of one of the add-ons for whatever reason needed. I don't remember the exact details, but I've done it. Like I like that that's available. I think there are people who appreciate that kind of thing. But I also sort of think, you know, for the mainstream audience that Apple and all these companies really are trying to address, I think the App Store does make sense and in many ways is the right approach because it's the right combination of that security and reliability and, you know, whatever. And for developers, you get the distribution and hopefully, you know, it's harder these days, but hopefully some kind of exposure to customers that you might not be able to reach otherwise.
I'm going to throw you a bone, Paul.
Okay.
Because this is exactly how Xbox works.
Yeah, right. I mean, right. So you can't sideload apps on Xbox. That's true. You don't hear a lot of complaints about that, I guess. Tim Sweeney probably goes to town over that, but he's an idiot. But yeah, so yeah, it's a closed system. I mean,
they're businesses and they have the right to close their system if they want. And you as a customer choose if you want to participate in it.
When you talk about somebody at some point in the chain, someone has the right to say yes or no to something. And we want it to be at the level, I guess, for developers or for users. And Apple is saying, look, it's our platform. We're going to be the one that says yes or no to certain things. If you don't want to do this, don't buy an iPhone. And I know that's exactly what Steve Jobs would have said to this argument, right? He would have said, if you don't like it, just don't do it. It's cool. But, you know, they've sold like a billion of these devices. People are stand in lines to buy these devices. Not anymore, but, you know, have for sure.
Yeah.
This is why you and I do not sit on the Supreme Court. That and the fact that we like
it. Yeah, this is one of the reasons. they have to apply law. In other words, you've talked about a legal precedent. What they have to do is look at that, say, does this apply to this digital thing? You're talking about bricks in Chicago from whatever time frame that was. We're talking about apps in a virtual store. I don't have that kind of mind for sure. I look at it more. I care about consumer harm. I consider myself kind of a consumer advocate. I despised Microsoft during the antitrust days in the U.S. for their anti-competitive behavior. Maybe it's a little simplistic. I don't know. But I look at the smartphone world today, and all I can think is we are awash in unbelievable choices up and down the price spectrum. And if you don't like Apple, and there are people out there who don't just because they're Apple or whatever, I get that sort of. Make another choice. You have that choice. At least that choice is there.
Well, we managed to get a half hour out of that. I didn't expect.
Can we? Yeah. Can we go back to my idea of Windows running on Linux for a second?
Wait, we didn't even talk about market cap, though. That meaningless statistics.
Oh, yeah. There. So if you look at the graphs of the charts of Microsoft and Apple's market cap, mm-hmm. they parallel. And then there's this brief moment in time where Apple goes, vroom, and Microsoft keeps going up. And then Apple, I think, came back up. But for briefly, Microsoft was worth more than Apple. And are you want to take a victory lap? Is that it?
No.
It's like 1 second.
I feel like it's a number that's kind of meaningless, right? Market cap.
Well, but it's, I've always said that. But the worst thing is, unfortunately, and you get this, Mary Jo, I know you do. The audiences that read our stuff or watch this podcast, there are some among them who take great delight in every misstep that Apple makes or every problem they have or whatever.
Well, and I do. They will be. I personally love it, but.
You shouldn't, but. Let me throw cold water on this little celebration. The problem with it is, remember the Steve Jobs quote, back from when Bill Gates was about to appear like Big Brother above his head, Boston Mac, Macworld event. And he said, we have to get over this notion that for Apple to succeed, Microsoft has to fail. People booed him and everything, Problem is, in this case, for Microsoft to succeed, Apple had to fail. Microsoft didn't do something awesome that catapulted their market cap past Apple. Apple just has been having all kinds of problems. That's the only reason it happened.
Right.
So, celebrate all you want, guys. But unfortunately, Microsoft didn't do anything to make that happen.
No.
And that's the little... What's the opposite of a silver lining? A little dog poop in a bag or something? I don't know. Whatever that metaphor is. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I just think it's funny to see all these headlines everywhere like, look, Microsoft, the most valuable company in the world. I'm like, yeah, okay. If you count market cap as a true measure of anything, and
it's
if you
a
think
measure
that
of
matters.
Something. I mean, it's a little more real world than, say, commercial cloud.
Right. Well, the actual definition of market cap, which I always look up every time because I'm like, what is it again? Yep. It's number of companies outstanding shares times the current market price of a share. Right. So, okay, whatever that number is worth.
It is a way to measure companies' relative values. But the thing I would say to this is, this summer when we were running up to the, which one's going to be first to 1 trillion,
Right.
There were four companies in the running at the time. Apple was always in first place, but Amazon and Google and Microsoft were always in the running. And the three of them kind of went down slightly different paths. But I think the important thing to note here is that all four of these companies are ginormous. And they all have very similar market caps. And that any one of them could buy most of the rest of the tech industry if they so desired. And there were no regulations against that.
Yep. So there.
I don't know. Does that count as a victory lap? I don't know.
When you look up the definition, I'm just curious, does market cap include, is it only outstanding shares or does it include shares held by the company?
I think it's only outstanding.
Outstanding. So that's another, not to be pedantic.
Well, it's meant to be, in other words, this is the public value of the company. And I think part of the reason why it's a real world number sort of is somebody might want to buy that company,
Right. Right.
How much would that cost?
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it would cost a lot.
Yeah.
Know that anyway. Know that much. Microsoft Cloud. I couldn't believe this yesterday. I saw Joe wrote about this.
Speaking of Groundhog Day.
Yeah, oh, man.
Yet another failure in Microsoft's two-factor authentication
server. I know.
Server.
So this is even more... ironic. So, last week on the show, we talked about how they had this 14-hour outage of their multi-factor authentication service right before Thanksgiving. Right after that happened, they did a very in-depth root cause analysis, which people gave them a lot of kudos for. They talked about what they found out. They found out there were three different causes. There was a race condition. Their telemetry failed. All these things. Okay. Everybody's like, okay, at least they were very upfront. And they had a whole plan laid out. Here's how we're going to make sure this doesn't happen again. Yesterday, MFA goes down again. And when people were reporting it to me on Twitter, I was like, no, are you talking about what happened before Thanksgiving? They're like, no, today. So they were down yesterday for several hours because of an MFA issue again. which they haven't yet posted a root cause analysis for, but they did say it's related to DNS somehow. I'll tell you, this is it, you couldn't have a worse week for this to happen. This is the same week of Amazon's reInvent conference. Microsoft's the number two cloud company. Amazon's the number one. Also, today was a Microsoft shareholder meeting. No one brought it up during the shareholder meeting, but it's not a good look, guys. Because a lot of people are using MFA as part of their, you know, they've got it integrated into their policies at their company. Like, hey, don't let people sign in without the two-factor thing happening first. And it was taking down people's Office 365. It was taking down Dynamics. It was taking down all kinds of services that use Azure Active Directory to authenticate. So, yeah, really rough timing on that. Not a good week for the cloud.
Did we speculated last time that it went down because they were making those changes so you could use a token to log in?
Yeah, they didn't say that was the case. They didn't bring that up as being connected, but who knows?
I think it, for the second time, too?
No, the second time they just said it was DNS. They haven't yet posted the full analysis yet of what happened yesterday, but it was multiple hours they were down.
These things happen. Just go home. Take the day off. It's a sign from above.
That's what people were saying. They're like, a lot of companies are like, well, we can't do anything, actually, at all.
I couldn't agree more. Exactly. This is like, happens to my daughter all the time with school. Like, there's always some problem at the school, and they have to like cut the day short if she doesn't go in.
Damn,
just
snow
enjoy
days.
That day.
Yeah.
Yeah, who cares what the problem is? Just like, I can't work. Sorry.
I think if you're a business, that it maybe means a little bit more.
It does. Yeah.
Probably.
A little bit more.
A little bit more to them. And then what is this Windows file system for AWS? I don't even understand this.
So I don't know if people have been paying attention to this reInvent conference today. Amazon announced like 500 new products today or something. Wow. It was insane. No, I'm exaggerating a little. But they had like three-hour keynote, and they announced so many products during the keynote. That's what tech intensity is, friends.
Yeah.
Lots of products announced during a keynote.
Wow.
Anyway, one of the products is something called Amazon FSx for Windows File Server. So what they did was they built a Windows file system for AWS because it's not just Linux workloads that are on the Amazon cloud, just like Microsoft, not just Linux on Azure. A lot of people want to run Windows workloads. So what Amazon did was they went and wrote a Windows file system from scratch, and they are making it available on AWS.
Is it called Samba?
No, it's called Amazon FSx for Windows File Server. And you know what else they announced today? I didn't put this in the notes, but they're going head-to-head with Azure Stack also. They announced something today called AWS Outpost. This is funny to me because Amazon used to be one of those companies that said, people don't need a hybrid cloud. Hybrid cloud's a fake cloud. No one needs to run on-prem. Well, they announced it today, AWS Outpost, just like Azure Stack.
Let me give Amazon some marketing ideas for this. They should package this server in a form that looks like one of the Amazon boxes that comes to your house when you get a package.
That'd be hilarious with a smile on it.
Like a fake tape around it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be awesome.
Yep. But anyway, yeah, if you have time, go look at the Amazon news blog because they have so many announcements up there. And it's interesting. A number of them are either head-to-head competing with Azure, catching up with Azure, in many cases surpassing Azure, or just Windows running on Azure. Pretty interesting.
Is this sort of their Ignite?
Yeah, kind of like their Ignite.
AWS?
Or like their Dreamforce, you know, one of these giant, here's everything we're doing right now conferences.
Well, it's nice to see a big tech event happening in Seattle, you know?
I know. They announced a mini race car. They like announced all kinds of crazy stuff.
They announced a race car?
Yeah, they did.
Like you can, what?
I just saw the headline, like Amazon just announced a race car.
Can you buy it?
I don't know. I didn't really dig into that one.
Really? Amazon
you're going to care.
I know, and I'm going to have to find out before Twig, because we're probably going to have to talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
So FSx, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, to offer, it's an alternative to
Azure.
Right?
Hold on.
Yeah, it's like Windows Server workloads running in the cloud on Amazon.
They have new blockchain services, Amazon Quantum Ledger Database, an Amazon managed black blockchain.
Right, blockchain also.
Yeah.
Yep.
Automated data labeling service called SageMaker Ground Truth.
Come on, you care.
That's amazing.
Now, here it is.
Are there Amazon, any data lights?
I think that my tell dentist me, tell me offered me that the lights. Last time I was there, the SageMaker Ground Tooth. I think that was something. No, I'm joking.
No, that's a hot
AWS, pot, AWS, guys, AWS Deep Racer, a 1/18th scale race car driven by reinforced learning.
I want it.
Not by a gerbil.
Not by a gerbil, by reinforced learning.
It's $400.
It's driven by reinforced learning.
I don't stuff. Even, this is like, they're, you know what they're showing? We got R&D. We got your R&D right here.
Right.
This is crazy.
They're just, I think they just announced things just because, why not?
It's like the microwave, but then they ship it. It's like,
yeah,
we weren't joking. That there it is. There's a picture of it. This is, we're pleased and excited to announce AWS Deep Racer and the Deep Racer League. New, wow. So you can.
Oh, it's like an esports thing.
Yeah, ML-powered cars. 1/18th scale, radio-controlled, self-driving, four-wheel race car. Oh, this is designed to help developers learn about reinforcement learning. And it's fun.
Huh.
It's fun, just fun. Like Hadoop. Fun.
Fun on the Autobahn.
No, and can I just throw in an aside here?
Yes,
I
please.
Also today I was watching the Microsoft annual shareholders meeting, and I'll tell you, this was kind of a not a revelation to you guys, but they led the demo showcase with gaming. Like that was what they went out there and they did like gaming demos and stuff. I was like, wait, I keep poo-pooing all this Xbox, but man, they really are putting a lot of marketing muscle behind
it. I think it demos well, and I think it's something most people, you know, it's colorful
to.
And
yeah.
fast-moving. And
it's really,
this is a lot of what Microsoft is not.
It's distracting.
True.
Plus, it is their one obvious consumer play.
Consumer play, yeah.
Has great recognition, you know.
True. Yep. Anyway, that's all I had to say about the cloud for today.
AWS.amazon.com/deepracer. I'm sorry. I'm still stuck on this.
You thought I was kidding. You thought I was kidding when
one.
I said it.
I am. You know he's going to order one.
I am immediately. What? Pre-order. Let's do it. With one click. Not released yet.
Oh.
It's $249. You save $150.
See?
Woo.
March 6th. All right.
Well, oh, it's way out there. Oh.
March 6th.
Well, I'm ordering it now.
Oh, boy. It'll come when the winter's over.
You know, March will be here before you know it.
It will.
Maybe I should get two, just so I can
smash them into each other and stuff.
Maybe I should get two.
That's my motto. I did that with the Facebook portal. I got two. I didn't need two, turns out. And then they say, oh, it's easy to return. So I go to their page. It says, if you want to return this, contact us. Have you ever tried to contact Facebook?
Or any of these companies?
Any of these. Contact us. Yeah. Oh, and I love it. It just says, contact us. That's not a link. There's no number.
Oh, that's amazing.
You figure it out.
You figure it out. You want to return this 30-day? You could return it 30 days, but you'll have to find us first.
Yeah. Yep.
AWS Outposts in partnership with VMware lets customers order and run data center hardware seamlessly.
Yep, that's the Azure Stack competitor. Yep. The Outpost
Inferentia.
Thing.
Yep. Inferentia. No, it's not a new Pokemon. It's a new dedicated machine learning chip coming next year to compete with NVIDIA and Google's TPU efforts. AWS Ground Station, a cloud service for satellite operators.
Yeah, that one's pretty weird.
How many of them are there?
Called, AWS Azure Sphere.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Well, we might have to start doing an Amazon show this week in Bezos.
This
week in Bezos.
Would actually be awesome.
This week I'm announcing Bezos Pesos. It's a new currency for use at Amazon.
You could talk about so many things, like everything from like holiday shopping to, you know, Azure Stack on one show.
Everything actually, you've ever wanted
everything.
To be incredibly dysfunctional. Can I be part of that?
Yeah. You can, Paul. You're signed.
That sounds crazy.
Put your name on the dotted line right here. Our show today brought to you by Grammarly. Paul Theroux, unsolicited, just the other day, said he uses Grammarly.
Yeah, I do. I love Grammarly.
It is a tool to help your writing be better. Not merely grammar mistake-free, that's the least of it, but clear and effective. It lets you show your best self through your writing. And I love it because I can use it everywhere. Even on iOS, there's a Grammarly keyboard. There's a browser extension. There's a desktop editor. The free product reviews critical spelling and grammar, but I think you want Grammarly Premium because here's why. You not only get the spelling and grammar, but you get advanced punctuation, structure analysis. It's actually impressive as heck that it can do this. You know, your structure's upside down here. You're starting the wrong style within context. It actually understands context, vocabulary suggestions, conciseness. It'll give you readability scores. This is very valuable. And it includes the information of hey, if this is a business proposal, this is a little too hard. If it's fine for an academic essay, if it's a casual blog post, you can all the different ways you might want to write because you write differently depending on what your audience is, right? And it helps you do that. Use Grammarly. I'll give you an example. While updating your resume, you'll get more callbacks. Use Grammarly when you're writing online descriptions for shopping. You'll get more sales. Write confidently at school, write confidently at work and on the go. And I'll tell you, even if Grammarly only found one flaw every, few days or weeks, you don't want that. It reflects badly on you. You don't want that one. Now, I have to be honest with you, Mr. Perfect Grammar here. I get corrections fairly frequently and often well received. It's not like there's a teacher looking over your shoulder. It's just Grammarly. So you could say, yeah, you know what? You're right. Do you ever look at Paul? They send you an email on your stats.
Oh, my email's awesome. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
So the last one I get my emails are amazing. So every week they send you the writing stat thing.
Mm-hmm.
It says your writing streak is, it says 54 weeks. I've been using Grammarly longer than that, but whatever. 64,677 words checked.
Wow.
Last week. 99 in the top 99 percentile of Grammarly users.
Yay.
Only more accurate than 33% of Oh, that might be because I was editing Brad's book.
Brad's 1,317
alerts. 8,520 unique words. Unique words than 99% of users.
Yeah, that's
and good. They also mentioned that 2,000 additional mistakes were found from Grammarly Premium, which of course has additional features.
Isn't that? And so that's the difference right there. Yeah.
Missing commas and compound sentences, yeah. Missing articles, split infinitive. Hate those split infinitives.
Yeah. You know, that's an easy one to boldly go where no man has gone before. Yeah. It's very easy to do that by accident. It helps me avoid cliches, which I really like too.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. Grammarly.com/windows. Get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today, right now. That's good. 20% off at Grammarly. Now, Grammarly has no E's in it. Grammar is spelled with two A's, weirdly enough.
Which you would know if you had this
if
thing
you
installed.
Had Grammarly, you know. GRAMMARLY.com/windows. 20% off. You got to get Grammarly Premium. I think you'll like it. Grammarly.com/windows. We thank them for making our writing better. Now, it's time for the back of the book. Paul Theroux.
One final thing about Grammarly is it's really strict on the Oxford comma thing.
Which it should be.
And so what's interesting about that is, I know this is Mary Jo's favorite topic. A lot of times I'll be quoting from a blog post that someone at Microsoft or Google or whatever has written. And those guys routinely leave off that last comma in the so-called Oxford comma. And I find myself just fixing it.
Come on. It just makes me crazy. Get with the modern program.
You think that, but eat shoots and leaves.
Yeah. See?
That's all I have to say.
Yep.
You it's need a comma.
I don't use it.
I know. And I think that much less of you because of that.
It's one of our biggest bones of contention.
I know. Yes, it's the equivalent
we're never really going to.
It's like Windows 10S.
Spaces or tabs in programming.
It's like Windows 10S.
Oh, well. All right. Enough frou-frou-y food. Let's get serious.
We know
serious.
Each other well enough that I know that this bugs her.
Like, I know.
I will bring this up from time to time. So the tip of the week is, once again, because it's not quite the beginning of the month, but is December 1st is happening over the weekend. And that means we're switching over to a new month for Games with Gold. We get another awesome four games. Cube 2, which looks amazing. Never Alone, which won't come out till the middle of the month, is like an award-winning game that looks incredible. And then Dragon Age 2 is another great game. Mercenaries I'm not super familiar with. But, you know, again, it's basically $60 worth of free games. If you're on Xbox Live Gold, be sure to grab that stuff starting on December 1st. Which is what, Saturday? Sunday?
Saturday. Oh, hard to believe we're in December
right up.
On Saturday, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Winter's almost over.
I like Dragon Age 2. That was a lot of fun. I thought that was a good game.
This last month was awesome.
Yeah.
So, app pick of the week is, it's sort of an app. It's really a service, but there is an app, is Project Fi, which is now called Google Fi. Sorry, I should have corrected that. But Google Fi is something I've been using full-time as my wireless carrier since a year ago, September. But I had an account for at least 2 years before that. I was using it on a secondary phone. I love this service, right? So it's $20 for unlimited text and calling, $10 per gigabyte. They cap you for cost at 6 gigabytes, so you never pay more than 60 every month for data. It's full speed up to 15 gigabytes for an individual. So if you go above that, they'll slow you down. You can just keep paying at the same rate, you know, the dollar or $10 per gigabyte. International, it works exactly the same. So data and texting is just, it's not free, but it's whatever it costs you in the United States. It doesn't cost you extra to use it there. LTE speeds, calls are cheap, you know, 5-10 cents a minute, depending on the country, whatever. You know, they have a VPN. It's got network switching. It's awesome. Love Project Fi. But the problem with Project Fi has been that it's only worked with a handful of phones. So Google-branded phones like the Nexus phones, Pixels phones, and then more recently a couple of other phones. There's two Motorola phones and two LG handsets that also work with Project Fi. As of today, this service now works with most Android phones and most iPhones, meaning basically anything from iPhone 5S on.
This is huge.
In the case of iPhone. It's huge, right? So yeah. The thing is,
you don't have to buy Google phones anymore.
Right.
No, well, I still will.
Well, I mean, this is going to simplify my life dramatically. I'm really excited about this. But if you're coming at this from another Android phone or from an iPhone, what you're not going to get is arguably one of Project Fi's better features, which is seamless network switching. The reason that this carrier has only been available on the Google phones and a few others is that the phones have to have special hardware in them.
I was wondering about how they were going to do that. They're not.
Yeah. So in the U.S.
So it would just be T-Mobile, right?
Yeah, it would just be T-Mobile. Yeah. So in the U.S., Project Fi actually goes out over T-Mobile, which is GSM, or Sprint, which is CDMA, or U.S. Cellular, which I don't know what that is, but it's probably GSM. And the idea is that as you're kind of roaming around in the world, it will hit the cell towers that are there and it'll always pick the best one. But you have a choice of three different networks now. If you're a Verizon customer or an AT&T customer or whatever, it's doing the same thing, but you can only basically hit your own company's towers or you pay a roaming fee, and it could cost extra. So it's kind of a nice thing. Now, you're not going to get that on an iPhone. You're not going to get that on another Android phone. And then on the iPhone in particular, there are some actually other changes. So iMessage works out of the box. You have to make a configuration change for it to work with text messaging, but that's simple. It's like you do with any NVMO. Visual voicemail doesn't work, and that might be a problem for people, but Google will actually send you a transcript of every voicemail that you get via text messaging.
That's kind of cool. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. So you still have to call in like it's the 1970s, but at least you do get voicemail that way. And off the top of my head, I think that's
somebody saying that's you it. Lose Wi-Fi calling.
You should not lose Wi-Fi calling
because they support it.
Oh, because you're talking because of the network switching. So,
yeah.
Oh, that's a good question. So I'm going to test this. I don't think you would. The fact that iMessage works out of the box tells me
right.
that Wi-Fi does work for texts and calls. But I'm going to test it. So I'm going to test it first in the OnePlus 6T. And see how that goes. That will have fewer limitations. I think on that particular, well, I'll see because I can see now that it supports certain features. So I'll see what it does on Project Fi. But I'm going to have to grab an iPhone soon and test that And that's going to be really interesting. And like I said, like this could change my cell phone usage dramatically. We'll see how that goes. But this is something to pay attention to. The pricing structure, I think, is very good. You can find some places that, depending on your usage, you might be able to save a couple of bucks. But the way that this thing scales and the way that it's super transparent and the way that they give you money back at the end of a month if you, you know, you go between like a gig and 2 gig of data and you use, you know, 1.2 or something, they'll actually give you a credit the next month for the 0.8 you didn't use. And it's kind of an amazing thing. And I mentioned this to my wife, for example. Her parents are on her Verizon account and they pay between the two of them, her parents, that is $90 per month for the two people. They probably don't even use a gigabyte of data every month. And I see, you know, at Project Fi, that exact usage for if they used a gigabyte for the two of them would be $45 a month. So they would literally save 50% just by switching to Project Fi. And they're on Android phones, so it would probably work out fine. It's definitely something to look into.
Yeah, I mean, I love Fi.
I do too.
I'm very happy
with it. Same.
International travel too. Don't forget that.
That's the best.
Yeah. That's the best thing about it. Yep.
We had a couple of international trips in October. We went to Paris and then we went to Dublin. And it was my wife and daughter and I on the first trip and then my wife on the second. In both cases, they were tethered off of my phone. And in one case, I had forgotten I'd forgotten to turn off the network sharing. So my daughter went into her hotel room that night and streamed Netflix all night. And that went over my Project Fi thing. So for that month, I actually hit 15 gigabytes of data usage. And
that's
the total cost was
point, right?
Yeah, I've never seen this before. So they actually will slow it down. The way they do this, again, so transparent and so nice, is they're like, look, you're going to hit 15 gigabytes. This is what's going to happen. We're going to slow it down. I decided to see what that was like because I was already back home. I didn't really need it that much. And I didn't find it to be objectionable, so it was no problem. And it was only, you know, a couple of days left in the month or whatever, the billing cycle. But you could choose to say, no, I want the full speed data. And then you for the remainder that you use from 15 on, you just pay that normal price again. So it goes back to the $10 per gigabyte. It's
That's awesome.
Completely reasonable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really, really nice.
So don't hesitate to use the hotspot or tether.
I go to town on it. Like when we were in Stockholm, same thing over the summer, you know, with the wife and kids again, we're out in the world. Like, just use it, you know, and you can get data SIMs. So if you have devices, other devices, whether they're iPads or computers or other phones that only want just to have the data, it all goes over the same account. You know, you don't pay for the SIM or whatever. You don't pay for the second line because it's not really a second line. But I think this service is incredible. And now that it's going to work everywhere, you know, again, slightly fewer features than on a Fi compatible phone. But it's no brainer.
I have two Google data SIMs, and one I use in an iPad. The other was using the HP Envy X2. Actually, I moved it from the Envy to the iPad. It's amazing. It just works. Mm-hmm. And you only pay for what you use.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it really is good.
Their app is fantastic. You know, Mary Jo knows you land in Amsterdam or whatever and it says, welcome to the Netherlands.
Yep.
You're not paying anything extra. It kind of spells it out. Like, here's what it looks like. It's fantastic.
Happy to say it now works in Monaco.
Nice.
Last time I was in Monaco, it didn't work. It was like weird because it's a smallest country. You're one square mile. Sure. You're Italy on that side, France on that side. So just if you lean, you could get it to work.
Yep.
But the last time I was there a couple months ago, it worked again. So it was just a brief moment in time. There are some countries it doesn't work in, but it's almost it's everywhere I've ever been.
Yeah. I think it's 170 plus countries.
Yeah. Good. Good. Now, I think we now move on from that to Mary Jo Foley and her enterprise.
AWS pick of the week.
Her AWS. It's time for This Week in Bezos with Mary Jo Foley.
Jeff Bezos, pick of the week.
What are you doing over there? What are you doing?
Hold on.
Is your cat giving
you... No, I'm having weird things with my sound.
Oh, can you hear me though?
Yeah. So you know how you have, I don't even know what these parts are called, but like this jack that goes into the little Focusrite box.
Yeah.
Yep.
It seems to be like not holding
the DIN plug or whatever.
Is it the?
It's not really. Yeah. It's like keeps getting loose or something. I'm not sure.
Is it the thick one that comes from the microphone?
Yeah.
The Canon. Yeah. The Canon plug.
Is that what it's called?
That's supposed to have a very solid click when you push it in. So
you know what that always reminds me of, Leo? Do you remember the old Commodore 64s used to have a plug like that?
Yeah, the DIN plug.
DIN plug, yeah. That's right. Okay. That's why I have that in my head. It's a DIN plug.
Yeah.
It's a DIN plug.
Like it's like it looks like an adapter to connect my headphone into that box or whatever. Anyway, it's fixed.
Oh.
Enterprise pick of the week.
Yes, ma'am.
So a year ago, I started doing some work with Brad and Paul over at BWW Media. And for a while, I went kind of silent because they were working to fix up the forums on Petri.com, which is their enterprise site. Well, the forums are open again now on Petri. It's petri.com/forums. And we're starting to try to crank things up over there. We're trying to get some IT pros to come in and talk with us about all the stuff I like to talk about. You know, Windows Server and Azure and DNS, MFA, all that fun stuff. So if you haven't checked it out in a while or ever, you should come over and see what's starting to happen. We're starting to percolate up some topics, maybe talk a little bit even about things like Amazon and Google Cloud. So, yeah. If you haven't checked it out, we're looking for people who can come in and be resources for the community. You know, people who can help answer questions when people are trying to figure out how to do things. Like on the MFA issue, for example, we're looking for people who might have a strategy like, okay, Microsoft MFA has gone down twice in 2 weeks. What are you doing as an IT pro in case this happens again? You don't want to shut off MFA, but what are you doing instead? So if you're somebody who likes that kind of stuff and wants to dig in, come on over and help us out.
This is great.
Wow. Yeah, we're just starting to get it re-going again, but I think it's going to be fun.
Petri.
Kind of like 1809.
Yeah.
Nothing like 1809.
Not really like that, but.
PETRI.com/forums. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And are you like the editor? Is this your job?
No, so my title is Community Magnet.
I knew it.
So.
I knew there was an awesome
title. Job. Yeah. My job is to try to like get people to talk. And if I see discussions that are very interesting or timely, to bubble them up and get more people to participate.
Actually, you know, you got to make a forum useful. You need people like that. That's really good.
Yeah.
Glad they're putting that effort in. That's great.
Yeah. So let's see how it goes. Come on over. And I have a quick second little enterprise pick of the week. It's more of a developer pick, but I just want to remind people, December 4th, which is next week, is Microsoft's annual Connect conference, which is one of their bigger developer conferences. This year it's virtual and it's free. So you can just sign up and watch all these sessions. Scott Guthrie is going to be on. Scott Hanselman's going to be on. Donovan Brown, who does all their DevOps stuff. There's going to be a lot of different topics. It's going to be Visual Studio. It's going to be .NET Core and .NET Framework and AI. And machine learning. They're going to touch all the bases that will be of interest to all kinds of developers. So put it on your calendar, December 4th. If you want to find more info, do a search for Microsoft Connect event, C-O-N-N-E-C-T.
Looks like fun.
Could be good.
Yay. You're going to go?
Well, it's virtual this year. It used to be New York, but not this year. So I'll watch for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. And then it's time for the code name pick of the week. We got one this week.
Yeah. Okay. We need some people to help weigh in on what this is. Taro Alhonen, who is an avid listener of Windows Weekly and participant, he found a list in the Windows SDK for 18282 of editions of Windows 10. We know what most of these are. They're things like Andromeda's mentioned and Enterprise and Azure Server Core. Then there's this thing called Lite, L-I-T-E. So Windows 10 Lite. The Walking Cat, our friend who does a lot of codename stuff, is speculating this has to do with Windows Core OS. I think it does too. But we don't know exactly what it is. It's not that thing that was Windows 10 Lean. That's something else.
Or Windows 10 Lean In. That's for
not
Facebook.
Lean In, yeah. Not Lean. But this Lite thing is something else. And again, my guess is Windows Windows Core OS, WCOS, is somehow figuring in this picture, but I don't know exactly what this thing is. So I just threw it out there as code name because I'm like, it's interesting, whatever it is, and thought maybe some viewers and listeners might have ideas.
Hmm. All right.
We don't know on that one.
I think you've earned a beer, my friends.
Think so. This could have been a pick last week, but it'll work this week too. From the brewery Destil, which is in Normal, Illinois, we have Destil Cranberry Creek. So, you know, creek is the word for cherry. So it's a combination of cherry and cranberry in a sour beer. It's really, really refreshing. Like it doesn't taste sour, too sour because of the cranberries, not too sweet because of the cherries. It's a perfect mix. Very tart, very sparkly, and only 5%. So you could drink more than one and still be okay.
Mm.
Very nice. A very nice sour. Not, like I said, not overly sour for people who are afraid of sours, but very, very good for this time of year. The Destil Cranberry Creek.
I'm going to avoid jokes about being up a creek.
Yes.
And just encourage people to try it. We are done.
We're done.
We're done. Our first post-Thanksgiving episode.
Okay, but what are you going to do on your birthday tomorrow?
Gravy and stuffing.
Tomorrow, I don't. First of all, as you will learn in many, many years from now, at my age, you don't really want to celebrate.
Come on, you're not much older than me.
After the big 6-0, it all's downhill, right? So I think Lisa and I, we have a big day in court on Friday. So I think Thursday we're going to celebrate by going to town and, doing something fun. There's a Gauguin exhibit at the museum. Maybe go see that. Have a nice dinner. Mm-hmm. And we are staying in town because we have to be in mediation early in the morning. So I think that's what we'll be doing.
So
I'll tell you about it if I can. No, I don't. No announcements.
You're not helping Apple in their court case.
I am an amicus curiae. No.
Leo, are you the reason the iPhone XR is not selling well?
It's my fault. No, definitely not. I bought one. I'm doing my part. What about you? Paul Thurrott is at Thurrott.com. Thurrott.com. It's double good. Double delicious, double fine. He's also publishes many books. His most recent, The Window 10's Field Guide, is available at leanpub.com. Buy two. They're cheap. Mary Jo Foley is at allaboutmicrosoft.com. That's her ZDNet blog. Together they do Windows Weekly each and every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. And that would be 1900 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can. Or listen live at twit.tv/live. We have audio and video streams there. If you do that, please hang out in the chat room. There's a nice bunch of people who are also watching and listening live. And it's kind of fun to be, like, you know, part of that group as you listen to the show, making snide comments, feeding me clever lines, that side of thing. And sometimes, every once in a while. No, they're good. Every once in a while, we get a YouTube video out of them. irc.twit.tv. Now, on-demand versions of every show are available at twit.tv/ww, going all the way back almost 600 episodes. You know, three episodes will be number 600 with 597.
That's going
to be some. 600 episodes. You can also subscribe, and that way you'll always get the latest version. Pocket Casts, iTunes Podcasts, whatever it is that you use to subscribe to podcasts. Look for Windows Weekly and get it automatically delivered to you. That seems to be the safest, sanest way to go. I should mention that voice assistants also work. You can ask almost any voice assistant, hey, you, listen or play the Windows Weekly podcast. Play the Windows Weekly podcast, and it'll give you the most recent version. That's a very convenient way to get it. I think we can now adjourn. Go back to your.
I'm gonna go try that. I'm gonna go run into my kitchen and talk to Google.
Hey Cortana,
see what comes up.
Play Windows Weekly. Sometimes you have to add
and
the
then
word.
She'll say
podcast.
It's cloudy and 44 degrees.
Exactly. sometimes you have to say podcast at the end. And on at least on Amazon, sometimes it helps to say on TuneIn. because that's where they're getting it from. But, you know, play around with it. It works on every...
Google knows enough about me to know that if I say that, you know.
I think so. Let me just... I bet you it'd work here. Let me try it on my phone. Play Windows Weekly.
No, I'm
all
curious.
I got was weekly.
Yeah.
You're weekly.
Play Windows Weekly.
Play Windows Weekly. Windows I'm just Weekly, talking to myself. Play Windows Redmond Weekly.
Freuda. Yeah, it's playing it. It even pronounced Redmond Freuda correctly, even though it's a made-up word.
It's time for Windows Weekly. Paul and Mary Jo are here.
It's the YouTube channel.
It's pretty clever, ain't it?
Also, for some reason, the second link was episode 563. Hello, God. It's me, Paul. I don't know. Well, because it's me. I was the one who asked the question.
Yeah, that's
why. That was me. It.
Yeah. Thank you, my friends. Have a wonderful week. And we'll be back here next week, right? Oh, I won't. I'm going to New York.
All right.
I won't be able to see you, Mary Jo, because
you know, that's interesting.
We're meeting with people. But
I actually was invited to go to New York next Wednesday for an event, which I said I couldn't go to because we're doing the podcast. And I guess I will keep that.
Well, you're still doing the podcast. I'm not still here, doing but the podcast. Jason exactly. Or Megan will sit in and probably yeah. Megan and yeah. And do it. But so don't think you're off the hook.
No, I didn't. It's just an interesting coincidence that you're going.
We're
to
going to see The Boss, Bruce Springsteen. That'll be on Thursday. Yeah. Wednesday, we're seeing Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, Part 1 and 2. It's a play so long you go to a matinee, then they let you out for dinner, and then you go back for the second part. But it's supposedly very good. I hope
nice.
So.
Yeah. Should be good.
And in between, we're going to meet with, you know, say hello to clients.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
The usual, you know.
Yep.
All right.
Well, hunting season is on, Leo. So if you guys have an extra day, come down to the Lehigh Valley.
Bring my
shoot
rifle.
A deer.
Okay. All right.
Shoot a deer.
I'll wear my orange.
They're so cute.
Dude.
Even dead, they look good.
Yep.
No, we wouldn't do that, Mary Jo. We just eat them.
I know
after
you wouldn't.
Facts. We don't shoot.
Just they're. I mean, marinated properly. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Someday an elk's going to get you right in the backside. Yeah,
really. Oh, there's no doubt of that.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time in December. We'll see you in December on Windows Weekly. Bye-bye.